Good afternoon, my friends. This is Jeffrey Bennett on this 10th day of October. What we have witnessed going on around the world in the last week or so is horrific. I have no favoritism to Israel. I have no favoritism to Palestine. However, the Israelis have been destroying Palestine for years. Back in 2000 and I can't remember when, 2009, maybe prior to that, I did a very intense program called Cast a Giant Shadow. We are going to air that entire two-hour program tonight. Stay with us. For those of you who may have an interest in the entire written concept of what you're about to listen to, you may send me an email, and I will provide you a PDF of this entire distortion. For absolutely no cost whatsoever. Let's get going with this program. It is very intense. I will see you in 2 hours for the third hour of tonight's Edge of Darkness. Stay with us.
I know your tribulation and your poverty, that you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Good day, Mr. and Mrs. America, and to all the freedom-loving Christians and patriots all across this great republic and around the world. We bid you welcome to a special two-part episode of Perspectives on America, and welcome to our near series, Cast a Giant Shadow, Gog, Magog, and the Kingdom of the Khazars. In the book of Ezekiel, chapter 38, verse 2, we are told, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. 1,000 years before the establishment of the modern state of Israel, there existed a Jewish kingdom in the eastern fringes of Europe astride the Don and Volga rivers. And so begins a thesis by Jewish author Kevin Allen Brook. The kingdom of which he speaks appears at first consideration to be comprised of nearly as much disinformation, misinformation, myth information, and curiously, no information, as there is actual provable historical fact. And yet upon closer scrutiny, this kingdom known as Khazaria, or the Kingdom of the Khazars, is clearly revealed in a vast body of historical evidence, much of which has come to light only in the last 3 to 5 decades. This mysterious kingdom, which has sculpted our modern world to an astounding and alarming degree, once occupied an immense land area over 1 million square miles, extending from western Hungary and Austria, eastward to the Aral Sea, north to the upper Volga, and its southern region extended to the Caucasus Mountains, between the Black and Caspian Seas. It was at that time literally the largest country on earth. It has only been in the last several decades, however, that the greater documented evidence from ancient manuscripts has come to light and revealed the astonishing historical truth of this ancient kingdom and its connection to the origins of modern-day Israel. Though little known to the West, and for that matter, to even those currently occupying its ancestral land, the Khazar kingdom has been responsible for substantially shaping the history and political landscape of Europe, and specifically Western Asia, but also to a remarkable degree the entirety of human events upon this planet. Arthur Koestler, author of The 13th Tribe, easily the most expansive single work on the subject, states thus, "The story of the Khazar Empire, as it slowly emerges from the past, begins to look like the most cruel hoax which history has ever perpetrated. This is the story of a kingdom of belligerent, warlike, Caucasian nomads, having no linked ancestry with anything Israelite this side of Noah, yet adopting Talmudic Judaism and becoming the dominant and virtually only current force in 21st century international Jewry. During the course of this work, this salient facts and issues will be presented without a too extensive reliance on tedious historical documentation. However, considering the delicacy of the subject, especially in this modern age where any divergence from certain agendas for political correctness can result in epithets of racism or anti-Semitism, and for the obvious sake of accuracy, reasonably comprehensive documentation is necessary. In this, it will be shown that the cry of anti-Semitism hurled against those who do oppose the international actions of ones calling themselves Jews would be much like an immigrated Scotsman to America deciding to live on an Apache Indian reservation, coming to dominate its politics and economics, and then claiming that anyone disagreeing with his political and social agenda is racist and anti-Apache in their beliefs. What, under different circumstances, could prove to be a dry treatise on Eastern European Jewish history is, if closely examined, actually a narrative of events that have laid a sequential pathway to and beyond the destruction of the New York World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. This historical timeline has been fixed in its present course, which, by all appearances, and in a most unexpected manner, is culminating in the fulfillment of the biblical prophecies of Armageddon. But then, it has always been so with prophecy. The most consistent aspect in the nature of prophetic fulfillment is that it is consistently surprising, or surprisingly consistent. God, you see, has invariably worked to complete his desires prophetically in ways that have not been understood until revealed in retrospect in the light of their actual happening. Shortly after the death of Muhammad in the year 632 AD, according to Columbia University professor D.M. Dunlop, Arab armies began a campaign northward, sweeping through the wreckage of two empires and carrying all before them until they reached the great mountain barrier, the Caucasus. This barrier, once passed, Dunlop observes, the road lay open to the lands of Eastern Europe. Had the Caliphate, or the armies of the Muslim Caliph, surmounted that immense geological deterrent unchallenged, the history of Europe, and indeed the rest of the Judeo-Christian world, would have been vastly different than it now is. You see, it was at the Caucasus, or Caucasus, however, that the Arabs encountered the Khazars, initiating a war that lasted over a half a century and effectively prevented Europe from becoming Islamic. So powerful, socially and militarily, were the Khazars that, as Kevin Allen Brook relates in his work, The Jews of Khazaria, a 10th century emperor of the Byzantines, Roman Empire, Constantine Porphyrogenitus sent correspondence to the Khazars marked with a gold seal worth 3 solidi, more than the 2 solidi that had always accompanied letters to the Pope of Rome, Prince of the Rus, Prince of the Hungarians. Rutgers University professor Peter Golden, referred to by Brook as one of the principal authorities on the Khazars, end quote, wrote, every school child in the West has been told that if not for Charles Martel in the Battle of Poitiers, there might be a mosque where Notre Dame now stands. What few school children are aware of, Golden emphasizes, is that if not for the Khazars, Eastern Europe might well have become a province of Islam. The Khazarian mounted forces, with a soldiery of mainly Turkic and pagan origin, could at times, and when accounted for, show a disastrous fierceness and cruelty to the enemies of Khazaria. They were also probably the most disciplined, as well as tactically and strategically the most potent martial power at the time and in that region. Evidence that they were supremely calculating in their approach to international matters lay in the fact that, in contrast to their brutality, Khazar officials were often consulted as diplomatic emissaries and mediators by all the political powers surrounding Khazaria. The Khazars, you see, and their empire were at that time both highly respected, greatly feared, and with good reason. At the peak of their empire, it is believed that the Khazars had a permanent standing army that could have numbered as many as 100,000 and controlled or exacted tribute, astonishingly, from 30 different nations and tribes inhabiting the vast territories between the Caucasus, the Aral Sea, the Ural Mountains, and the Ukrainian steppes. During their zenith, Khazaria completely girded the lands of what are currently Astrakhan, Kalmykia, Dagestan, Volgograd, Rostov, Ingushetia, Kabardino, Balkarsk, North Ossetia, and Chechnya. At its maximum extent in the 9th century, Khazaria not only encompassed the northern Caucasus and the Volga Delta, but also extended as far west as Kiev, capital of Ukraine. Soviet archaeologist M.I. Artemonov states that for a century and a half, the Khazars were the supreme masters of the southern half of Eastern Europe and presented a virtually impenetrable bulwark, blocking the Ural-Caspian gateway from Asia into Europe. And during that entire period, they held back the onslaught of the nomadic tribes from the east. And until recently, a great part of the problem with the historical obscurity of ancient Khazaria lay with the fact that the geographical area of the country was part of the Soviet Union, which insisted on interpreting archaeological data within the framework of Marxist historical materialism. This Iron Curtain version of historical revisionism caused the Soviets to interpret that data in such a way as to prevent, as fact, that which was well fabricated but wrong. You see, this peculiar and obscure race inhabiting that land were described as blue-eyed and a very fair complexion. Commonly, they had long, reddish hair and were reported as very large of stature and fierce of countenance. Other sources have added observations that there were black Khazars and white Khazars, noting that the latter were light-skinned and handsome, while the former were dark-skinned. This has, however, been rather conclusively refuted by scholars who have established that the distinction was not racial, but social. The black or Kara Khazars constituted the lower strata or caste, while the white or Ek Khazars were of the noble or royal classes. This type of class distinction was fairly common in Eastern Europe, as evidenced by the more commonly known terms as Black Russian and White Russian, denoting not skin color, but class. In his book, An Introduction to the History of the Turkic Peoples, Peter Golden claims that the Chinese Tan Shu Chronicle describes the Khazars generally as, quote, tall, with red hair, ruddy-faced, blue-eyed. Black hair is considered a bad omen. And of the ferocity and warlike tendencies of the Khazars, there is little doubt and much historical evidence, all of it pointing to a race of people so violent in their dealings with their fellow men that they were feared and abhorred above all peoples in that region of the world. The Arab chronicler Ibn Sa'id al-Maghribi writes, "They are to the north of the inhabited earth towards the seventh clime, having over their heads the constellation of the plow. Their land is cold and wet. Accordingly, their complexions are white, their eyes blue, their hair flowing and predominantly reddish, their bodies large, their natures cold, their general aspect is wild." The 19th century monk Druthmar of Aquitaine in his commentary on Matthew 24, verse 14, writing in his book, Exposito in Matthewim Evangelistim, stated that the Gazari or Khazars dwelt in the lands of Gog and Magog. You see, legends and stories abound, some of which are true, according to the above-quoted Aquitaine monk, that center around Alexander the Great and his attempt to enclose the Khazars and quarantine them due to their violent and barbaric nature. Enclose and quarantine from whom? From the rest of the civilized world. This endeavor apparently failed, Druthmar claims, and they escaped. Sublegends even claim that they were cannibals. After the kingdom's conversion to Judaism, the term Red Jews came into usage out of the superstition of medieval Germans, who equated their red hair and beards and their violent nature with deceit and dishonesty. It is also well documented that they were heavily taxed, those passing through their lands, for none dared refuse them. According to Benjamin Friedman, himself a Jew, and an apparent long-time associate and confidant of presidents and statesmen, in an address presented in 1961 at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C., the Khazars were so belligerent and hostile that they were eventually run out of Asia and scattered amongst the nations of Eastern Europe. Heinrich von Neustadt, around 1300, wrote of them as the terrifying people of Gog and Magog. The territory of the Bulgars, themselves legendary for their fierceness in battle, was conquered by the Khazars in AD 642. A portion of them fled westward to the region of the Danube in the Balkans and formed what is now modern-day Bulgaria. Even in modern times, Muslim history recalls the Khazar raids and the terror of those inhabiting that land. To this day, they call the Caspian Bahr ul-Khazar, the Khazar Sea. It is not difficult to determine some of the motivating factors behind the legendary Khazar ferocity in war. When in the Beck, the Khazar head of the military, and second in command only to the Khagan himself, when the Beck sends out a body of troops, they do not, in any circumstances, retreat. If they are defeated, everyone who returns to him is killed. Sometimes he cuts every one of them in two and crucifies them, and sometimes he hangs them by the neck from trees. Logically, my friends, it would seem that this would not likely happen more than once, since reason would reveal to even the dullest soldier that defeat was not an option. Such a practice would also have provided a strong impetus to the legend of Khazar fierceness, since when faced with the choice of winning in battle or facing a worse death at home, the options and the rational responses to them become painfully distinct. All of these facts, mingled with the semi-factual legends of Alexander the Great and his attempts to wall up the Red Jews and isolate them, has led to the numerous mythologies of the coming escape at the end of time of Gog and Magog from the area enclosed by the Caucasus Mountains. This, as the legends say, in order to fulfill biblical prophecy in the final destruction of the world. Indeed, even Islam has such legends in its mythology. In a writing by the Imam Ibn Kathir, he asserts that the Prophet Muhammad has claimed, every day, Gog and Magog are trying to dig a way out through the barrier, the Caucasus Mountains, and that we begin to see the sunlight through it. The one who is in charge of them says, go back, you can carry on digging tomorrow. And when they come back, the barrier is stronger than it was before. This will continue until their time comes and Allah wishes to send them forth. As shall be shown throughout this program, the Muslims to the south of the Khazarian kingdom had good reason to attach such legends to their ferocious northern neighbors. However, you see, no nation can long survive, no matter how strong, by being exclusively belligerent. A lesson we may wish well to take today. But the Khazars, they were not an exception to this. As a vital addition to their brutality, they were possessed of a native calculating wisdom in knowing, as the Gambler's Creed says, when to hold them and when to fold them. The persistent political sense became evident in their diplomatic encounters with the Romans. The Roman Empire, or Emperor Heraclius, in 627, formed a military alliance with the Khazars for the purpose of a final defeat of the Persians. Upon the first meeting of the Khazar king, Zibel, with the Roman Emperor, the Khazars displayed in full array their skills at diplomatic flattery, skills that would serve them well and would not disappear with their kingdom. He, with his nobles, dismounted from their horses, said Gibbon, and fell prostrate on the ground to adore the purple of the Caesar. So enamored was the Byzantine Empire with this display of obeisance that it eventually led to the offer, along with many riches, of the Caesar's daughter Eudocia in marriage. That union never took place due to the death of Zibel, while Eudocia was en route to Caesarea. However, after the final defeat of Islam's designs on the northern kingdom in AD 730, a marriage between a Khazar princess and the heir to the Byzantine Roman Empire resulted in offspring who was to rule Byzantium as Leo the Khazar. And thus, the king of the north had skillfully managed to place himself on the throne of the Roman Empire. And yet, after the defeat of the Persians, a new triangle of power emerged, consisting of the Islamic Caliphate, Christian Byzantium, and the newly emerged Khazar Kingdom of the North. It fell to the latter to bear the brunt of the Arab attack in its initial stages and to protect the plains of Eastern Europe from the invaders. And because of their unique geographical location within the cusp created by the Caspian and Black Seas on either side, and the frightful stone barrier, the Caucasus Mountains, along their southern border, defending their land was made considerably easier. This situation of geography was, according to historians, one of the major factors in shaping the history of Eastern Europe, the European continent, and ultimately the world as we know it today. The Khazars had, for years, been venturing far southward in their marauding raids on the Muslim countries south of the Caucasus. And now, in the early part of the 7th century, Islam came northward through the same Kazbek Pass the Khazars had used and began a long war with the northern kingdom. The major attempt of the Muslim armies to take control of the Transcaucasus came in 622, while Muhammad was still leading Islam. They conquered Persia, Syria, Mesopotamia, Egypt, and surrounded the Byzantine heartland, which is present-day Turkey, in a deadly semicircle, which extended from the Mediterranean to the Caucasus and southern shores of the Caspian. And this began a long series of incursions by both sides, both Khazaria and Islam, that lasted for another 30 years. These wars eventually saw the Arabs defeated at every advance, finally ending in 652 with the death of 4,000 Arab soldiers, including their commander, and the Arab armies in complete disarray. This inability to traverse the Caucasus successfully made it logistically impossible for the Muslim armies to create an effective siege against the Roman capital of Constantinople. Had they been able to outflank the capital across the Caucasus and round the Black Sea, says Arthur Koestler, the fate of the Roman Empire would probably have been sealed. It was this fortuitous situation, coupled with the military barrier presented by the Khazars themselves, that prevented Europe from coming under the crescent moon of Islam and creating a very different history than that which has been. And now, following this expulsion of the Arabs from the Khazar homeland, the kingdom began to war for territory rather than spoil, incorporating the conquered people into an empire with the stable administration ruled by the mighty Khagan, The title given, the Khazar King, sometimes spelled K-H-A-G-A-M. Kagan, who appointed his provincial governors to administer and levy taxes in the conquered territories. At the beginning of the 8th century, their state was sufficiently consolidated for the Khazars to take the offensive against the Arabs rather than merely defending themselves against Muslim attacks. There was a brief period of Muslim incursion into Khazaria where the Caliph Marwan II, in a surprise two-pronged attack, drove the Khazars as far back in their own land as the Volga region. His only terms for peace were that the Kagan convert to the true faith, Islam, with which the Khazar king complied, but apparently only long enough for the Muslim Caliph to withdraw back across the Caucasus. This incident preceded by only a few years the Khazar monarch's conversion to Judaism. Most historians agree as to the motivation behind the Caliph's withdrawal. The Muslim ruler apparently realized that, unlike the more civilized Persians, Armenians, or Georgians, the barbaric Khazars could not be kept under military rule at such a distance. As mentioned previously, most historical accounts credit Charles Martel and his Franks for saving Europe from Islam. But this Anglicanized version of history does not, either by ignorance or design, consider the fact that the Franco defense of Western Europe would have been futile had not the Khazars stopped the Muslim onslaught from the east. The astounding historical result of all of this is that the Khazar kingdom was able, eventually, to set up and depose an empire from the throne of the greatest ruling power on earth at the time, the Roman Byzantine Empire. And this apparently was only the beginning, though the records of antiquity until recently have largely lost sight of this historically obscure but immensely influential people. Interesting side note, by the way, to the legendary Khazarian ferocity, again reveals their budding nature as negotiators and consummate politicians, a talent that only intensified under Talmudic Judaism. In the 13th tribe, Kostler tells of the Byzantine emperor Theodosius II, who was intent on securing the friendship of the warrior race, but the greedy Khazar chieftain named Karadak considered the bribe offered to him inadequate and sided with the Huns. Attila defeated Karadak's rival chieftains, installed him as the sole ruler of the Akatzers, a name given the white Khazars, and invited him to visit his court. Karadash thanked him profusely for the invitation and went on to say that it would be too hard on a mortal man to look into the face of a god, for as one cannot stare into the sun's disk, even less could one look into the face of the greatest god without suffering injury. Attila must have been pleased, for he confirmed Karadash in his rule. The death of Attila the Hun, however, precipitated the collapse of the Hunnic Empire and left an Eastern European power vacuum which the Khazars eventually filled. They then proceeded to subjugate all other surrounding tribes to the extent that shortly after their defeat, those tribes went virtually unmentioned in subsequent historical accounts. The Khazars had just swallowed them up, historically speaking. The most difficult time they encountered in their conquest was from the Bulgars, who were crushingly defeated around AD 641, with a great many migrating westward toward the Danube. And as previously mentioned, eventually establishing what is now modern-day Bulgaria. What you're listening to on this broadcast today casts a giant shadow. In Chapter 1 of this multi-part series, we must endeavor to establish the historical basis correctly, both from long-missing historical data, which has become available in the last probably 30 to 50 years. And as we go along through this series, we're going to incorporate much of the biblical teachings as we endeavor to look deeply into the kingdom of the Khazars and in fact, how this is translated over the centuries into this modern-day thing that we call Judaism or Jewry, From A. Kostler, this quotation: "A warrior nation of Turkish Jews must have seemed to the Western rabbis as strange as a circumcised unicorn." According to Benjamin Friedman, the Khazars' conversion to Judaism was first precipitated by their monarch's abhorrence of the moral climate into which his kingdom had descended. Now, Friedman has claimed, and other historians confirm, that the primitive Khazars engaged in extremely immoral forms of religious practice, among them phallic worship. Animal sacrifices were also included in their rites. The Khazar religious structure centered around a shamanism known as Tengri, which incorporated the worship of spirits and the sky, as well as Zulatri, the worship of animals. Tengri or Tengri was also the name of their immortal god who created the world, end quote. And the primary animal sacrifices made to this deity were horses. The actual mechanics of the Khazarian kingdom's turn to Judaism was, most historians agree, rather well thought out, from a humanistic perspective at least, rather than random and capricious as some have believed. According to George Vernadsky in his book A History of Russia, in AD 860, a delegation of Khazars was sent to Constantinople, now known as Istanbul, which was then what remained of the ancient capital of the old Roman Empire turned Christian under the Emperor Constantine. And their message was thus: "We have known God, the Lord of everything." Of course, they're referring to Tengri. "From time immemorial. And now the Jews are urging us to accept their religion and customs, and the Arabs on their part draw us to their faith, promising us peace and many gifts." The Arabs' faith, we assume, we're discussing Islam. Well, this appeal in all its implication was obviously made for the purpose of drawing the Christian Roman Empire into the debate with an eye perhaps toward a balanced argument amongst the major monotheistic religions. Now, Brooke makes the observation that, quote, "This statement reveals that the Jews were actively seeking converts in Khazaria in 860. He also adds that in the year 860, Christian saints, Cyril and Methodius, were sent as missionaries to the Khazars by the Byzantine emperor, Michael III, since the Khazars had requested that a Christian scholar come to Khazaria to debate with the Jews and the Muslims. Inasmuch as the world has seldom or perhaps never witnessed any culture of people more adept at the art of religious debate than rabbinical Jews, the Khazars' conversion to Talmudic Judaism is not a surprising outcome, given that such a forum was to be the determining factor in their choice rather than purely spiritual perceptions. The outcome was even further assured by the fact that the Christian representatives in the debate came from a church in the latter formative years of the Holy Roman Empire, in which, by that time, spiritual sensitivity had become somewhat rare to nearly extinct. It was at that period of time, about AD 740, that King Bulan of Khazaria was reputed to have converted to Judaism. In the debate among the Islamic mullah, the Christian priest and the Jewish rabbi each presented to the king the advantages and truths of his own precepts of faith. This king, however, according to some accounts of history, had his own logic for determining which he should embrace. He asked each representative in turn which of the other two faiths he considered superior. The result was that the Muslim indicated Judaism over Christianity, and the Christian priest chose it over Islam. The king then concluded that Judaism, being the foundation upon which both of the other monotheistic religions were built, would be that which he and his subjects should embrace. The Khazars themselves, being monotheistic, had also apparently expressed reservations about the polytheistic nature of the Trinity doctrine of the Christians. And so, is not to exclude the Islamic account of these events. The following is taken by D.M. Dunlop from Al-Bakri's 11th century work, The Book of Kingdoms and Roads. Quote, "The reason for the conversion of the king of the Khazars, who had previously been a heathen, to Judaism was as follows. He had adopted Christianity, and then he recognized the wrongness of his belief and began to speak with one of his governors about the concern with which he was filled. The other said to him, 'O king, the people of the book form three classes. Invite them and inquire of them, and then follow whichever is in possession of the truth.' And so he sent to the Christians for a bishop. Now there was with him a Jew skilled in debate, who disputed with the bishop, asking him, 'What do you say about Moses, son of Amram, and the Torah, which was revealed to him?' But the other replied to him, 'Moses is a prophet, and the Torah is true.' And then said the Jew to the king, 'He has admitted the truth of my creed. Ask him now what he believes.' And so the king asked him, and he replied, 'I say that the Messiah, Jesus, the Son of Mary, is the Word, and that he has made known the mysteries in the name of God.' And then the Jew said to the king of the Khazars, 'He confesses a doctrine which I not know, while he admits that what I set forth, but the bishop was not strong in bringing proofs. So he invited the Muslims, and they sent him a learned and intelligent man who understood disputation. But the Jew hired someone against him who poisoned him on the way so that he died. And the Jew was able to win the king for his religion.'" Kostler presents an interesting alternative to these views. His position was that the king's conversion was essentially a political decision. At the beginning of the 8th century, Kostler tells us, the world was polarized between the two superpowers representing Christianity and Islam. Their ideological doctrines were welded to power, politics, pursued by the classical methods of propaganda, subversion, and military conquest. It may be observed here that it is quite evident modern Christianity has well learned this same form of statecraft. In other words, propaganda, subversion, and military conquest, inasmuch as they have torn a page directly from the first millennium history of the church. You see, the Khazar Empire represented a third force, my friends, which had proved equal to either of them, both as an adversary and an ally. But it could only maintain its independence by accepting neither Christianity nor Islam, for either choice would have automatically subordinated it to the authority of the Roman Empire or the Caliph of Baghdad. And although they suffered no want of protected efforts by either Islam or Christianity to convert the Khazars to their respective religions, it resulted in no more than an exchange of political and dynastic courtesies, in other words, intermarriages, in shifting military alliances, etc. It was now clear that the Khazars were determined to preserve their supremacy as a third force in the world, an undisputed leader of the countries and tribal nations of the Transcaucasus. They saw that the adoption of one of the great monotheistic religions would confer upon their monarch and benefit of both prelatic and judicial authority that their system of shamanism could not, and that the rulers of the other two powers clearly enjoyed. Author J.B. Barrie concurs, "There can be no question that the ruler was actuated by political motives in adopting Judaism. To embrace Mohammedanism would have made him the spiritual dependent of the caliphs, who attempted to press their faith on the Khazars. And in Christianity lay the danger of his becoming an ecclesiastical vassal of the Roman Empire. Judaism was a reputable religion with sacred books, with which both Christian and Mohammedan respected. It elevated him above the heathen barbarians and secured him against the interference of Caliph or Empire. It would be illogical, however, to think that the Khazarian rulers had embraced Judaism blindly without intimate knowledge of what they were accepting. They had encountered the faith numerous times throughout the preceding century from traders and refugees fleeing persecutions at the hands of the Romans, and to a lesser degree, Jewish flight from the Arab conquests of Asia Minor. Benjamin Friedman expresses differently the science behind the process of choosing a national Khazarian religion. He claims that there were much more informal and random and not nearly as intellectual in their approach. You see, it matters little what the mechanics were of the conversion of the Khazar kingdom to Judaism. It matters only that it happened. And that it happened with a clanging historical ring that resounds to the present age. The religion of the Hebrews, writes Berry, had exercised a profound influence on the creed of Islam, and it had been a basis for Christianity. It had won scattered proselytes. But the conversion of the Khazars to the undiluted religion of Jehovah is unique in history. You see, it is indeed a historical event, as Berry claims. However, it is also interesting that he should refer to their conversion to Talmudic Judaism as, quote, the undiluted religion of Jehovah, end quote. It is evident that present day Ethiopian Jews would disagree with Mr. Berry on this matter, since they do not adhere to the precepts of the Talmud, Mishnah, Midrash, or any of the extra-biblical writings that have arisen since the close of the Old Testament canon. These Jews of North Africa claim only Torah as their scriptural authority. And unlike their distant brothers of the Talmud, they practice their religion quietly and with relatively no involvement in worldly politics. According to an ancient document entitled King Joseph's Reply to Hazdai Ibn Shapret, Joseph, a later Khazarian king, stated that, quote, from that time on, the Almighty God helped him, King Bulan, and strengthened him. He and his slaves circumcised themselves, and he sent for and brought wise men of Israel who interpreted the Torah for him and arranged the precepts in order. See, there appears to be as many historical accounts as to how King Bulan was converted to Judaism as there are historians and mystics to present them. Notice the word mystics. Many of them involve visions of angels, such as the tale by a Sephardic Jewish philosopher detailing a dream in which an angel told the king that, quote, his intentions are desirable to the Creator, end of quote. But the continued observance of shamanism was not. In the aforementioned document, King Joseph's Reply, its author replies that in that same dream, God promised King Bulan that if he would abandon his pagan religion and worship the only true God, that he would bless and multiply Bulan's offspring and deliver his enemies into his hands and make his kingdom last to the end of the world, end quote. Well, it is believed by scholars that the dream was designed to simulate the covenant in Genesis and meant to imply that the Khazars too claimed the status of a chosen race who made their own covenant with the Lord, even though they were not descended from Abraham's seed. King Joseph, you see, corroborates this in his document as he claims to have positively traced his family's ancestors back not to Shem, father of the Shemites, or Semite peoples, but to another of Noah's sons. Kostler states, through a fierce Jewish nationalist, though a fierce Jewish nationalist, proud of wielding the scepter of Judah, he cannot and does not claim for them Semitic descent. He traces their ancestry to Noah's third son, Japheth, or more precisely to Japheth's grandson, Togarma, the ancestor of all Turkish tribes. Kostler adds a footnote to King Joseph's genealogical claims that is piercingly relevant to this study, where he states, "It also throws a sidelight on the frequent description of the Khazars as the people of Magog." Magog, according to Genesis 10, verses 2 and 3, was the much maligned uncle of Togarma. End quote. Now add to this that the two other sons of the Japheth, the progenitor of the Khazars, are Meshach and Tubal, central figures in biblical prophecies of the end times. King Joseph's reply also revealed the successor to King Bulan, his son Obadiah, reorganized the kingdom and established the Jewish religion properly and correctly, end quote, bringing in numerous Jewish sages who explained to him the 24 books, the Torah. Mishnah, Talmud, and the order of prayers. This entrenchment in the Jewish religion outlasted the kingdom itself and was transplanted whole cloth into the Eastern European settlements of Russia and Poland. Whatever the religious machinery and or chicanery that was set in motion to accomplish the task, the consequence is historically undeniable that the Khazarian king was indeed converted to Talmudic Judaism. And the temporal consequences of that conversion have rung down through history like a warped and distorted bell, answering clearly to prophetic declarations of the last days of Earth's history. The Khazarian kingdom reached its peak of power and world influence in the latter half of the 8th century. And yet the death knell of their empire was eventually seen in the dragon-headed ships of the Vikings who were to cross and navigate all the major waterways in their onslaughts. Even the legendary ferocity of the Khazars was outdistanced by these Norsemen who, quote, did not deign to trade until they failed to vanquish. They preferred blood-stained, glorious gold to a steady mercantile profit, end quote. They were also called Rus, from which descended, among others, the Russians. And because historical Scandinavian literature did not begin until after the time of the Vikings, little of actual fact is known of them, with much of its contradictory. Much of it is contradictory. Almost none of it is laudatory. Of their military powers, however, virtually all accounts are in harmony. In his book, The Magyars in the Ninth Century, C.A. McCartney quotes the Arab historian Ibn Rushd as stating, "These people are vigorous and courageous, and when they descend on open ground, none can escape from them without being destroyed, and their women taking possession of, and themselves taken into slavery." There was even coined a specific term for the Viking ferocity. A word I may or may not be able to pronounce. Berserkgänger, from which is derived the English word berserk. Such were the prospects which faced the Khazars. And yet even in light of their viciousness and military prowess, these Norse Vikings focused their pillaging assaults on the Byzantine Roman Empire, preferring to trade with the Khazars rather than to tangle with them. And though eventually outmatched in ferocity, the Khazars were still able, for a while, to exact their 10% taxes even from the Vikings on all of their cargo, more correctly spelled as plunder, that passed through their land. An interesting story emerges from this period of the Khazar Empire, by the way, that gives a clear vignette of the emerging cultural schematic that was eventually to be scattered throughout the world. In the year 912 AD, the Rus Vikings, with an armada of 500 ships, each manned by 100 warriors, were set on invading and plundering the Muslim lands south of the Khazars, with whom the Khazars had a loose alliance of protection due to the thousands of loyal Muslims in the Khagan's army. The Rus commander, however, sent a letter to the Khagan asking permission to pass through his territory, to which the Khazar king acceded on condition of receiving half of the spoils upon their return. On the Vikings' return from their bloody mission, and paying the tribute required by the Khazars, or tribute is a polite word for tax, as you know. The Muslims loyal to the Khazarian monarch who lived in the eastern part of his kingdom requested of the Khagan that they be permitted to fight the Vikings in retaliation for what they had done to their brethren to the south. The king granted them permission to do so, which resulted in the complete eradication of the Rus force, except for 5,000 or 6,000 who escaped and were subsequently killed by the Butas or and the Bulgars to the north. Here you see pictured is a classical perspective of what was to become the Khazar Jewish heritage in nearly all of their dealings. Business, social, or cultural, a king who becomes a willing, though passive confederate of marauding Rus Vikings, claims half the loot they have taken in their bloody assault, licenses a retributive attack against them by Muslims under his own command, but then informs the Vikings of the imminent reprisal he himself has authorized. That sounds an awful lot like a Rothschild, does it not? The weakening of the Khazar military influence had a very wide and unexpected influence in that it greatly hastened the extinction of the Byzantine Empire. They no longer had a powerful force on their eastern borders to prevent the Vikings, the Mongols, and others from invading an already weakened dominion. This, and internal factions within Khazaria, was the prologue to the scattering of the Khazar Jewish seed throughout Russia and Eastern Europe, and eventually, as shall be shown, to the reshaping of world history. The swan song of the Khazar kingdom, well, it was not a precipitous decline in a climactic or decisive series of battles, but rather a gradual, evolutionary succumbing to superior forces over a protracted period of time. Notice I emphasize the word evolutionary. In general, writes S.W. Barron, the reduced Khazar kingdom persevered. It waged a more or less effective defense against all foes until the middle of the 13th century, when it fell victim to the great Mongol invasion set in motion by Genghis Khan. Even then, it resisted stubbornly until the surrender of all its neighbors. But before and after the Mongol upheaval, the Khazars sent many offshoots into the unsubdued Slavonic lands, helping ultimately to build up the great Jewish centers of Eastern Europe. Here then, remarks Kossler, we have the cradle of the numerically strongest and culturally dominant part of modern Jewry. The ancient Hebrew nation had started branching into the diaspora long before the destruction of Jerusalem. Ethnically, the Semitic tribes on the waters of the Jordan and the Turco-Khazar tribes on the Volga were, of course, miles apart, but they had at least two important formative factors in common. Each lived at a focal junction where the great trade routes connecting east and west, north and south intersect, a circumstance which predisposed them to become nations of traders, of enterprising travelers, or rootless cosmopolitans, as hostile propaganda has unaffectionately labeled them. But at the same time, their exclusive religion fostered a tendency to keep to themselves and stick together, to establish their own communities with their own places of worship, schools, residential quarters, and ghettos, originally self-imposed, in whatever town or country they settled. This rare combination of wanderlust and ghetto mentality, reinforced by messianic hopes and chosen race pride, both ancient Israelites and medieval Khazars shared, even though the latter traced their descent not to Shem and the Shemites, but to Japheth. And yet the more recent diaspora resulted in a strong, oftentimes politically overwhelming Khazar Jewish influence in especially Hungary and Poland, but also in the whole of Eastern Europe. Jews were found in positions of power and political influence in virtually every major category of life, business, and society. Oh, there may have already been a small population of what Kossler calls real Jews living in that religion, but there can be little doubt that the majority of modern Jewry originated in the migratory waves of Khazars who play such a dominant part in early Hungarian history. The Khazar influx into the Hungary-Poland region was only a small part of an overall mass migration from their homeland to Eastern and Central Europe. They were employed as mint masters, administrators of the royal revenue, controllers of the salt monopoly, which, if you know your history, at that time salt was a valuable commodity, often used in place of money. And from this comes the saying, worth his salt. Ah, let's not forget the Jews were also tax collectors. They were money lenders. In other words, they were bankers. Western European Jews historically displayed such a talent and acumen at trading and as usurers, money lenders, that in virtually any society and culture in which they found themselves, they became the possessors of and controlling influence over large portions of that nation's wealth. In the Dark Ages, the commerce of Western Europe, writes Cecil Roth in the 1973 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, was largely in Jewish hands, not excluding the slave trade. And Jew and merchant are used as almost interchangeable terms, end quote. The floating wealth of the country, Roth continues, was soaked up by the Jews who were periodically made to disgorge into the exchequer, the national or royal treasury. It was evident that the ruling class periodically became intimidated by the mass of their nation's wealth, accumulating to the hands of so small a minority, and a very clannish minority at that. This would logically give any ruling authority cause for concern when a particular group virtually controls the nation's economics while at the same time appearing to have a tenuous allegiance to the country in which they reside. Such a course of events evidently would lead to the creation of a stereotyping blueprint for Jews and Jewish communities, which has been expressed and reacted to in various cultures for centuries. The nucleus of modern Jewry, remarks Kossler, thus followed the old recipe, strike out for new horizons, but stick together. And this, as previously mentioned, was the course of Western European Jews, but in the similarity between them and the Khazarian Jews is striking, especially in their unequaled aptitude at things economical and political. This mass of historical data has led several historians to conjecture that a substantial part, and perhaps the majority, of Eastern Jews, hence of world Jewry, might be of Khazar and not of Shemitic origin. The far-reaching implications of this hypothesis may explain the great caution exercised by historians in approaching the subject, if they do not avoid it altogether. Thus, in the 1973 edition of the Encyclopedia Judica, the article Khazars is signed by Dunlop. But there's a separate section dealing with the Khazar Jews after the fall of the kingdom, signed by the editors and written with the obvious intent to avoid upsetting believers in the dogma of the chosen race. And we shall continue with part two of Cast a Giant Shadow. We have spent this hour establishing the groundwork for what is now known and believed to be modern day Jewry. It is going to come as a shock to some. To others, this has been a tedious, fact-filled hour, filled with quotes, filled with historical accuracies. Many listeners do not get excited to hear the amount of detail that we push into a specialized series of this caliber. But you see, my friends, it becomes necessary. For in the second part of Cast a Giant Shadow, we shall expand into the more modern commentary. Without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
Our customers love this back-saving innovation that enhances sanitation and speeds production. Next, our beef cradles with stainless steel or aluminum frames eliminate rust and corrosion. We hope you'll compare our quality and prices for this essential part of your processing line. Our cradles are especially effective when used with our power skinner. And finally, our hook tumbler will keep your hooks clean and polished. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. cows, too.
Ezoff LLC, 417-932-6419.
You can't handle the truth!
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit republicbroadcasting.org today, because you can handle the truth.